One of the more moving images from the United Nations meeting on climate change a few days ago was of people from poorer countries. They're clearly worried, not just about what could happen to them soon, but what's already happening now. Putting aside the graphs and the models and arguments about gases, these folk are responding to nature itself. The natural world where they live, or where they're trying to live, is different. They expect their homes to be wiped out, and they say that the ponderous progression of international negotiations may well leave them with nowhere to go. This is Dr. Ariel Saleh's concern. She's a sociologist specialising in political economy at the University of Sydney.
It bothers me that the G8 and development experts always talk about capacity building for non-industrial communities in the global south. Because as I see it, capacity building is just what's needed in the global north. And I'm not alone in this. In Anchorage recently, the Indigenous Peoples Global Summit pointed to the ecological debt notched up by affluent societies as main contributors to global warming. They spelled out their own vision of self-managed local economies based on food and energy sovereignty. And they told the UN that the time had come to hold technical briefings by Indigenous peoples on traditional knowledge and climate change. Governments and international agencies have not given due credit to the capacities of peoples at the margins of capital. There's a tacit environmental racism too in letting these others pick up the tab, like when a nuclear waste dump is put in Aboriginal country, or when a red scheme converts the livelihood of Kalimantan farmers into a carbon sink for our coal-based consumer lifestyle. The rhetoric of international partnership does little to soothe the assault. True, conservation NGOs are anxious about the impact of rising seas on island peoples, but racism appears again in the claim that the populations of India and China are the biggest threat to global warming. For ecological footprint studies show that the consumption per capita in China is negligible compared with the average individual footprint in Australia or the US. The ecological footprint indicator is a terrific instrument for keeping policymakers honest. But mathematical formulae won't shift the totally ethnocentric idea that our model of production is the only viable way. In fact, the fixation on adjusting input-output parameters simply delays a more thoughtful response to climate change. This crisis asks us to stand back and look at why we've configured our humanity-nature metabolism so badly. Metabolism is the process by which humans take from nature, digest, and give back in return. And cultures across the world have devised different ways of managing it. The pioneering ecological economist Nicholas Georgescu-Rogan made it centrepiece of his new discipline, bringing biological systems and thermodynamic principles into economic reasoning. Yet today, sustainability science deals largely with the tip of the production iceberg. Most transfers between humans and nature are meta-industrial, non-monetized, and not even named as economic. Sociologists give various explanations for our strange modern disconnect from the natural. John Bellamy Foster attributes it to the metabolic rift between town and country. Corporate globalization and free trade now exporting this rift across the earth. Peter Dickens sees ecological alienation as an outcome of the industrial division of labour. And the more technologically improved daily life is, the more people lose a feeling for their own organic embodiment as nature. Ecofeminist Sylvia Federici uses the word amnesia to describe this psychological splitting. The humanity-nature split is very clear in the language of ecological economics. I quote, "Natural capital can be considered the planetary endowment of scarce matter and energy, along with the complex and biologically diverse ecosystems that provide goods and services directly to human communities, water recycling, pollution, and so on." Here, scarcity is an ontological constant rather than a man-made anomaly. Living systems are pulverized for turning into profitable goods. Metabolic flows are pulled apart and abstracted as factors. There's little grasp of human coevolution with the environment. And what's more, the gendered, class, and racialized origins of economics itself are bypassed. Of course, there are also innovative moves in sustainability science. Herman Daly, albeit from the World Bank, matches the canon of efficiency with a call for global justice. He knows too that biological time is slower than economic time, and that intergenerational equity calls for thinking with a long time horizon. Yet the heritage of neoclassical economics is still active in Daly's work. His core variables of scale, distribution and allocation function in an ad hoc system whose imaginary boundaries are never justified. His cybernetic analogies reify the market, much as the old hidden hand of liberalism did. And descriptions of economic processes in the passive voice set up a sense of inevitability that deflects people from making change. As a sociologist of knowledge, I'm only too aware that the transformative potential of any discipline is stymied as long as sociological bias in its analytic tools goes unnoticed. Thus, Daly and confreres omit to ask, who is it that decides on scale? Who distributes to whom? Who is entitled to make allocations? And why? Sure, conferences in ecological economics now include sections on peasant and indigenous societies, and sometimes even host a feminist symposium. But my impression is that these are add-ons, problem areas, distribution conflicts, or externalities waiting to be assimilated to the master map. If the amnesia of industrialization were shaken off, would it then become respectable to talk about other ways of satisfying human needs? For example, a 2007 Food and Agriculture Organization report notes that the greater part of the world's food supply is actually produced by peasant cultivation. The celebrated ecofeminist and former quantum physicist, Vandana Shiva, tells us how this eco-sufficiency is achieved by meta-industrial workers in North India. It is women who manage the integrity of ecological and human cycles. As healers, they gather medicinal herbs among the trees, and as catalysts of fertility, they transfer animal waste to crops, returning the byproducts to animals as fodder. Their daily round, protecting natural sustainability and human sustenance, is an exemplar of scientific complexity in action. Aboriginal Australians, too, make the seasonal walk through country with deliberation and disciplined harvesting to ensure renewal. 3 hours' work a day suffices in this bioregional economy. According to John Gowdy, a student of Rogan, the hunter-gatherer rarely extracts more matter or energy than needed for maintenance. Don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that everyone should head for the hills, but arguing that the epistemology of these alternative production models provides essential capacity building for a global regime like ours, staring at a wrong-way-go-back sign. In regions where communal land is undisturbed by European ideas of development, self-managed indigenous economies are both sovereign and synergistic, satisfying many needs at once. To paraphrase Chilean economist Manfred Max Neef, besides subsistence, they foster learning, participation, innovation, ritual, identity and belonging. Against this, our engineered satisfiers use up much energy and time, often sabotaging the very convenience they were designed for. I mean, take a look at Al Gore's future vision of solar and geothermal cities in the US Southwest. This will consume vast amounts of front-end fuels in road-making, welding turbines and power grids, water supply, component manufacture for housing, air conditioning for supermarkets. There'll be new ecosystem damage and psychological costs from mass resettlement. And is the lost farmland there to be made good by overseas agricultural leases? How then will displaced Central American peasants feed themselves? And how much more heat will be generated by haulage of food back to the US? Let's face it, the economy of permanent consumption and green conversions is not only ethnocentric, it fails the thermodynamic test. So how do models of peasant and indigenous provisioning stand up as sustainability science? What are their methodological features? First, the consumption footprint is small because local resources are used and monitored daily with care. Closed-loop production is the norm. Scale is intimate, maximising responsiveness to matter-energy transfers in nature, so avoiding entropy. Judgments are built up by trial and error, and using a cradle-to-grave assessment of ecosystem health. meta-industrial labour is intrinsically precautionary because it is situated in an intergenerational time frame. Lines of responsibility are transparent, unlike the buck passing that mars bureaucratised economies. With social organisation less convoluted than in urban centres, synergistic problem solving can be achieved. In farm settings and in wild habitat, multi-criteria decision making is simply common sense. Regenerative work reconciles timescales across species and readily adapts to disturbances in nature. This economic rationality distinguishes between stocks and flows. No more is taken than is needed. It's an empowering work process without a division between workers' mental and manual skills. The labour product is enjoyed or shared, whereas the industrial worker has no control over his or her creativity. Such provisioning is eco-sufficient because it does not externalise costs onto others as debt. Autonomous local economies imply food and energy sovereignty. You get the picture. Here is a people's science that vies closely with the advice of good environmental consultants in the global north. The trouble is that in growth economies, that advice too often gets shelved by governments under pressure from business. Or unwieldy administrations foil the translation of principles into action on the ground. Beyond this, our capitalist states are so dependent on resources from the meta-industrial periphery, the exacting sustainability practices of the global majority must remain invisible. Yes, technical briefings by Indigenous peoples are going to be indispensable if international decision-making is to become coherent and democratic.
But how would it work, you may ask? The G20 in conversation with peasant farmers next time, perhaps? Dr. Ariel Sulley is a sociologist specialising in political economy at the University of Sydney. Next week, a talk from Albury Wodonga, where Dr. Susan Lawler has been getting her students to write letters to T.H. Huxley. But T.H. Huxley's dead. Very, very dead. So what's that about? Find out next week. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.